mentioning just a few more things about it before proceeding to some examples. So last time we got to the point of defining BCFW recursion relations for any n, k, and l. And this had this structure of two kinds of terms. The normal BCFW term that we're familiar with at tree level, where here we have some n left, k, oops, some n left, k left, l left loops. Similarly on this side with rights. Where, of course, n left plus n right minus 2 is equal to n, k left plus k right minus 1, k left plus k right plus 1 is equal to k, and l left plus l right is equal to l. Okay? So that's the that's the usual recursive form. Now, if this had this been the only term, notice that it would imply that all loop integrands can be reduced down to three particle loop integrands, and the three particle loop integrand vanishes. So there's no so that's why, even though this form is perfect at tree level, it recursively determines all tree amplitudes in terms of the three particle amplitude, it was insufficient at loop level. It needs an inhomogeneous term, a source term that knows about loops, that puts in that the loops exist. And that was the origin of this new term that we could associate, that we could express in this manifestly Yangian invariant way. Which involved starting from an n plus 2, k plus 1, and l minus 1 object, adding particle 1 as an inverse soft factor, and removing a and b. And this was symmetrized in all the loop momenta for more than one loop, in all the loop variables, A, B, L. Okay, so reviewing the logic, we deform Zn goes to Zn plus Z1, Zn plus Zn minus 1. There's two kinds of poles that we encounter in that deformation. One of them involves factorization channels where sums of the external particles go on shell. Those are the ones associated with the standard BCFW terms. The other ones are ones that involve putting a single internal propagator on shell. So that is a single cut of a one lower point loop amplitude. And that single cut is the residue. So the residue of the first set of poles is just obviously this product of loops, lower point loops on the left and the right. The residue of the second sort of poles are the forward limit, because it's involving a single cut. It's the forward limit of the one lower point loop amplitude with two extra particles added between 1 and n. And so that's these guys, and those are all the poles that there are. So purely logically, just to get the recursion relation for the integrand, nothing else, straight in momentum space, however you want, in whatever space you want to do it, that's all we're doing. Okay? The non-trivial things here are there's two non-trivial things. A, that the integrand exists, which is a statement that's true for planar theory. It exists, and it's well-defined. It's a rational function, a well-defined rational function. So you can determine it if you know its poles under a reasonable deformation. That's the first non-trivial thing. And the second very non-trivial thing is that these forward limits exist in this theory, that the forward limits are well-defined, these single cuts are well-defined. And that is the observation that goes back to Simon's work in the context of the Feynman tree theorem. That's it's very beautiful. It's very important to the story. Actually, his story about the Feynman tree theorem is very interesting in itself. He developed how to think about the tree theorem beyond one loop, which is something that Feynman couldn't figure out how to do. But there is some way of talking about the tree theorem beyond one loop. He pushed it to two and three loops, and there's a very interesting story there, which has at the moment no very direct connection to anything else going on here, but seems beautiful and important. But anyway, quite apart from all of that, we're very importantly using this observation that the forward limit is well defined in n equals 4 super Yang Mills. Yes.
Grassmannian and define your theory by taking another Grassmannian. It will not be n equals 4, but by definition, it will be a theory which will be Yangian invariant. And
yes.
And then it will define the whole of the integrand of that theory. So would that be a way of getting four-dimensional theories, which would be by construction?
Well, I'm not sure what. So,
if you're Grassmannian, but instead of putting such four, pick some other group, and.
Let me make two comments about that. First, the obvious extension is the SLM slash M for NEM. Okay, so that's fine. I don't know what those theories mean. I don't know what space time interpretation they can possibly have. But I haven't thought about it very much. I should say there was a paper that I haven't studied, so I can't, but
I'll just tell you the claim of the paper that came out about 3 weeks ago, that there seems to be a Grassmannian formulation for scattering amplitudes in ABJM. So there's a formula that looks more or less the same. Instead of having K by N minors, it has K by 2K. It's instead of a K by N matrix, it's a K by 2K matrix. Which makes sense because there aren't helicities in three dimensions. So you don't have, there isn't really a K sector. There's just bosons and fermions. So there's a formula that looks very similar with consecutive minors and with K by 2K matrices that's claimed to compute, that's claimed to be Yangian invariant, first of all. So claims to establish that ABJM has a Yangian symmetry. And secondly, claims to do exactly for ABJM what this does for n equals 4 super Yang Mills.
It will not be very hard.
Oh, sure. That's
something which will not be this.
That's right.
Which will be some theory which we didn't identify yet, which will not be n equals 4, but...
Perhaps, in fact, I mean, if you just start with the philosophy of playing bosonically representing the delta function just in this Grassmannian way, then nothing stops you from doing it. In fact, only at the end, the place where you start being obstructed is when you want to write down GLK invariant measures. So what happened here very, very early on is you say you have this nice picture for the delta function. Now you want to for the momentum serving delta function. Now you want to say it in a GLK invariant way, and you can't do it. So you can only do it by adding four Grassmann coordinates in order to make sure that everything is GLK invariant. Of course, that's not quite true. By the time you extract specific helicity amplitudes, all the SUSY is gone. You still have a nice Grassmannian formula, and what's going on is that you have some extra miners upstairs that are making up for that are making up for the GLK ones. And in fact, the miners upstairs, the ones that you put upstairs, have a very nice meaning.
If you put the miners that correspond, if you put these particles to negative helicity and the other ones to positive helicity, you just put the miners associated with the negative helicity guy to the appropriate power, to the fourth in the numerator, and you're done. So there is a nice Grassmannian formula, very non-supersymmetric, just for describing ordinary QCD. It doesn't have fermionic data in it. It doesn't have Grassmann data. But of course, that formula literally, right.
Right, because you need the fermions to sum over what.
Definitely. That's right.
So, I mean, yeah. There's another thing you could do, which Whitman suggested in a different context, which is,
yeah,
you've got to have the delta four bosonic, because that's basically four dimensions, and then you need a number of fermions to balance that. And so, if you say the fermions scale in the same way as the bosons, then you need four fermions. But you could say that the fermion scale, like a single fermion, scales like 4 power. Of the bosons, and then you just have a delta 4/1, but it would be a 1 which carries weight 4, if you like. And then you get a different set of miners from expanding the fermions. I have no idea what theory that would be, but.
But could you not expand the miners? Could you keep the fermions?
The fermions, but
yeah. He's just giving it another example, another way of making it work.
Maybe n equals 1 theory, I'm not sure.
Right. One can certainly start orbital. I mean, there's trivial things you can start doing. There seems to be something, at least in the loop story, there's something physical and important about the fact that the sum of the supermultiplet makes the forward limit what will define. I should say, just backing up for a second, the fact that the forward limit is, I mean, if you want to go the other way, that there are a number of things that are just obvious when you write things in a dual conformal invariant way. So obvious that you don't even bother thinking about whether they might go wrong. Okay. So, for instance, the fact that there is no pole of infinity in momentum space under the BCFW shift, this thing we said twice already, which in the standard momentum space thing about BCFW is one of the main obsessions. How do you prove there's no pole of infinity? It doesn't even come up. The issue doesn't even arise in momentum twister space, because that pole of infinity, as we discussed, would involve something having to do with the infinity twister. Okay? So just having it be dual conformal invariant just makes it impossible for that to happen. Now it depends on your attitude a little. If you want to, you could say, aha, so that means it's very non-trivial that the theory is dual conformal invariant. Well, yes, it is non-trivial, but it's dual conformal invariant. But those facts become correlated with each other. Okay? So you believe the dual conformal invariant, so maybe the whole issue just disappears. Similarly, the forward limits are manifestly well-defined. If I've given you an integrand, I know exactly what the poles can look like in momentum twister space, or the form AB12, AB23, and so on. There's just a single pole, as we discussed, as we were testing yesterday.
If under the BCF shift it's a single pole, then there's no choice for its residue but to be the forward limit, and it had better be well-defined since the integrand is well-defined. So you just trip over it without even realizing that something amazing is going on, starting in the dual space. Okay? But these are some of the things which are not generically true if you don't have the dual conformal limits. So both of those things are things that are remarkable without dual conformal invariants, that are almost obvious if you're imagining that things are dually conformal invariants.
More remarkable than either of those things.
Yes, exactly. No. I'm
just making equivalence between statements. Okay, so. Okay. And so that's the, in principle, complete perturbative definition for the integrand. And so that's very nice, using only on-shell notions, and presented in a way that's manifestly Yangian invariant. And as I mentioned, why do you care about the manifest Yangian invariants? We could have said all these things without ever saying the word Yangian. We could have said it all in momentum space. We could have done, but it's for three reasons. First, you see where the symmetry is, you see the symmetry isn't just the, some piece of crap that's only there at tree level and isn't doing anything else. It's really doing something very powerful. It's being broken purely by the choice of the integration contour, which is forcing you into infrared divergent regions. And that fact should be useful. We haven't, I'll talk about a little towards the end of the talk, we haven't actually figured out how to make it useful yet, but it morally should be useful. When you have a symmetry that's broken in a very controlled way, it should still be giving you information. It should be ultimately telling us how to carry out these integrations so we understand why the answers are actually simple. And there is some astonishing evidence that the full integrals are also very simple, not just so that's one thing. It's nice to see in what sense the symmetry is actually there, to see it as manifestly as possible. Secondly, this Yangian invariant way of writing it is perhaps pointing to deeper ways of thinking about what this object actually is, because this looks like the way of calculating something which is defined invariantly in some other way. And especially the fact that the seed of the loop amplitudes is so tightly connected to these basic operations for hiding particles is very suggestive to us. That if you did exactly the same operations on a different contour, you'd be doing nothing interesting, simply eliminating particles. So it's consistent with a sort of philosophy that there's a fundamental object out there defined for an infinite number of particles, and what we're doing in trying to describe the scattering of a fixed number of particles is doing canonical operations to remove infinity minus n of the particles and look at n remaining ones. And the entire, so you start with one well-defined object, and at tree level, this already works, by the way, right? If we just want to talk about the tree amplitude, we're now free to talk about the infinite particle tree amplitude. And then if you want to talk about n particles, you literally remove them. Now, of course, you could also say this in momentum space, and removing them means taking soft limits. But there it's a little bit ugly. This whole big object that you're talking about, in the limit where the momentum of all these other particles become soft, starts becoming singular. You've got to strip off these singularities to keep going. Here it just looks more natural. You have these very simple operations that literally take you down, remove the particle. There's no divergence to deal with. You just strip them off, and you keep going down. So already at tree level, we're allowed to talk about a picture where the fundamental object is the infinite number of particle tree amplitude. And then somehow removing pairs of particles in an interesting way is giving us loops. That's, I think, that's something that would be hard to see without representing what this seed term is in this Yangian invariant way. Also, this way of representing it lets us, lets us start to see how we can understand the remaining feature of BCFW. Well, the one thing that just like at tree level, BCFW does not make manifest, the cyclicity of the answer, the absence of spurious poles. Those facts for tree level amplitudes were eventually understood as consequence of residue theorems in the Grassmannian integral. And as I showed you yesterday, the cyclicity of the MHV one loop amplitude we also understand in terms of residue theorems in a Grassmannian integral. Okay? That's, again, something which is not handed to you just staring at the you need to see the full Yangian invariant formulation in order to be able to see that. And something I should have stressed yesterday, which I didn't, is that at one loop, checking the cyclicity of these results is the same as checking unitarity very directly. Okay? In fact, unitarity and more. But unitarity is very literally a residue theorem. If I hand you, you see, what this is really very, it's just, we're just saying the same words as you do at tree level, moving up one loop. But BCFW is making some of the single cuts of the amplitude manifest. One of the sets of single cuts are being manifest. Now somehow all the other single cuts work out miraculously when you sum over everything. Just like at tree level, some of the factorization channels are manifest, and the other ones occur miraculously when you sum over everything. Okay? But certainly one of the single cuts is manifest. That one, this single cut is manifest, is manifestly correct. That single cut is manifestly correct. So if you prove that the amplitude is cyclic, that proves that all, it's cyclic and doesn't have spurious poles, that proves that all the single cuts are correct. If all the single cuts are correct, all the double cuts are correct, all the triple cuts are correct, and that's unitarity and all of its friends, okay? So unitarity and all of generalized unitarity can now very explicitly be seen to be a residue theorem, for at least for the limited case of the one-loop MHV amplitudes, where we can understand that, where we understand the deeper origin, or a deeper origin of these identities that relate to different formulations of the same amplitude. So those are the things that that you win conceptually by representing this object in a manifestly Yangian invariant way. And of course, as I mentioned already, literally thinking about it in this form with these GL2 contour integrals and everything also is just very powerful computationally for letting us actually do the calculations. But having said all of that, I say for the last time that that the two basic important points you can try to pursue for any theory. First of all, for any planar theory, the integrand exists. There's a rational function. And, you know, if we can't compute it, shame on us. So we must be able to compute it. And the only obstruction is figuring out what these single cuts mean for a totally general theory. Probably what's going on is that in general, you don't have single poles. You have double poles, or there's something like that. There's some subtlety that has to be sorted out for a general theory. But it's not some, it doesn't seem like some gargantuan, impossible problem. It's a very isolated, specific problem. Probably has lots of nice physics associated with the difference between SUSY and non-SUSY theories. But it's, I think, sharply posed. If it isn't solved in 6 months, it's probably impossible. And so there's no reason for any of this Yangian stuff to show up. No obvious reason for it to show up there. Okay. So let me now do, let me just do one simple example of how this formula works. So the example is one loop MHV amplitudes. This example is very simple because it doesn't have any of the first kind of term at all. Okay? Because it's MHV, you can't jam together any lower guy to get it. So all we have are, we have two contributions. There was the pole at infinity, which was the one lower point amplitude. And we have what we get from the forward limit. Okay? So the formula for Mn is Mn minus 1 plus the forward limit contribution. Okay? Yeah?
You wrote the recovery relation in momentum twist displacer, and the reason for doing it was to make everything beautifully Yangian invariant.
Right.
You started with a Yangian invariant topic, you did some Yangian invariant operations to it,
yes.
So the result you get is Yangian invariant. On the other hand, that recursion relation is just the standard BCFW recursion relation at loops, if you like.
Yes.
Not so standard.
Yes, absolutely.
So I could have done it for an n equals 1 theory, at least. And there, what goes wrong? I mean, I'm still doing the same operation. So the operations I'm doing are Yangian invariant.
Oh.
But the theory isn't Yangian invariant, so it must be just that the starting point wasn't Yangian invariant, but the starting point was just the three.
Well, no, I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure how I would get going with the. Well, I don't think that. I mean, I don't even know how to get going with n equals one. Even to say the fermionic part of all these things is crucial, right? The fermionic part of all this stuff is absolutely crucial. Also, in momentum twister space, so there are all these R invariants that have all their fermionic. I don't know what else to say. I mean,
okay, the n equals 1 past that is just the straightforward n equals 1 recursion relation.
Oh, true.
In momentum space.
True, true. But of course, at loop level, everything is running around the loop, so we can't isolate just n equals 1 part.
That recursion relation in momentum space, and just say again, it's n equals 1. So I just sum over n equals 1 particles running through the not through n equals 1. That's the n equals 1 recursion relation.
It's true. It's true that the n equals 1 recursion relation is BCFW, BCFW plus forward limits. That's definitely true. What I don't know is whether those things are manifestly Yang-invariant because there isn't a Yang. Indeed, you know, both those terms I can say, and let me just say it again. You see, there's a very sharp little, very small but sharp technical point. The ultimate loop integrand, the ultimate loop integrand is over bosonic variables, right? D4x, D4y, right? So that's the object. That's the object. If you want to hit it directly with the recursion relation, that's what you're computing. So what we're doing here is introducing all this, we're introducing redundancy that isn't needed for, it isn't needed for the actual end of the day integrand. But as usual, redundancies are useful. They let you see things. It's this redundancy that lets you see this is a Yang invariant object. And that's what would be very hard to see without the redundancy. We're starting off there. The loop integral, one loop, is a four-dimensional integral. That picture is beginning as a six-dimensional integral. Okay, it's beginning as an integral over a full ZA and a full ZB, and then doing the integral over this GL2 in this particular way, right? And it's got extra fermions in it. And all of that extra freedom is what's letting you see that it's manifestly Yang-invariant. It's also letting you see that it has this striking interpretation in terms of removing particles, such that if you did it on a different contour, you would just get something boring. You would get a manifestly Yang-invariant leading singularity. See, if you just stared at the actual invariant bosonic integrand, you could do it, but then many things would be surprising. It's Yang-invariant is surprising. Why are its leading singularities what they are? Why does leading singularities satisfy all these relationships? So all of those things would be relatively surprising. And having these extra redundant variables is making those things more manifest. So since I don't even know how to get going for the Yang for n equals 1, I'm not sure. But of course, the claim is that there's two terms, and in n equals 1, they both have correct, good physical interpretations, and we know what they are. And we can determine them in terms of on-shell data. Yes?
Question that you probably asked a minute ago. Do you define two basic operations which involve one or two particles? Are all of these operations closed under the documentation?
What do you mean are they closed?
Well, they first add a particle and then merge two.
Because they're defined so that each one at a time mapped an invariant to an invariant.
Right.
So that was the point. So of course they're
he has to think. What you're saying is that the commutator will map invariant invariant. Is the commutator, is again one, is...
I don't know. So I think the question is, do we know all of the interesting elementary operations? I don't know.
What can you span with this set?
Sorry?
What are the full things you can span with this set?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I suspect you can make everything out of them. I don't know why. It just sort of feels that way. Certainly everything you need to get the whole theory. So
I didn't mean that.
But I understand your question. I don't know the answer, but I suspect that they generate everything. But maybe not.
Maybe it's just close.
It might be close. I haven't checked. Okay. I should have said something, by the way. I don't think I said it explicitly. Remember, in there was a pole at little z goes to infinity, which we said is the one lower point amplitude, and then there's the other ones, and then there's a forward limit. When I draw that picture, I'm including the pole at infinity as one of those pictures. The term with j equals 2 there would just be one of those. Just so I don't keep drawing m one lower point plus these guys plus the rest of them. That's because that pole infinity is exactly the k preserving inverse soft factor acting on the It's exactly the BCFW term involving the three-point function on the other side, which is the k-preserving inverse cycle. Okay, so, all right, so for one loop at matching amplitudes, we have the one lower point for the endpoint amplitude is the one loop amplitude is the one lower point, one loop amplitude, plus the forward limit term. There's no other terms with BCFW jamming two guys together, just by k counting. Okay. So in that case, the recursion of, so the formula immediately turns into a double sum, right? Because you write mn as mn minus 1 plus something, and then you just recursively write mn minus 1 as mn minus 2 plus something, and you recursively keep going down. So the formula that you get is a sum over j. Now, what we want is particle 1 added between a and b, 1 in general sum n, and so on. So remember that what this is just n, 1, a, b, this is n minus 1, n, 1, a, b, times the lower object evaluated so in this case, it would be the NMHV tree amplitude, evaluated at the shifted locations for n hat, which is n minus 1 n intersect 1 a b, and a hat, which is a b intersect n minus 1 n 1. Okay. So here what I get is, so now I have a sum over j. The sum over j, this is going to be summing over, so I start, I want the endpoint amplitude, so I have the mn minus 1 plus the forward limit term, and I keep recursively inputting the formula. I keep going down the mn minus 1 to the mn minus 2 plus its forward term, mn minus 3 plus its forward term. So this j here is going to label that index. I started with n, then n minus 1, n minus 2, so on. So what I'll get is a sum over j with that factor with the No, so we're going to do that in a second as well. But we're writing mn is mn minus 1 plus forward limit. And then for that mn minus 1, it's itself a loop amplitude. We're writing it as mn minus 2 plus its forward limit, right? So we're writing that mn minus as mn minus 2 plus its forward limit. So from each one of these things, we're getting a forward limit term. We're getting the forward limit term from mn minus 1, the forward limit term from mn minus 2, and we keep going down until we hit the one loop three-point amplitude, which is nothing. Okay. So in this way, we're just writing it as a stack of a sum of a bunch of forward limit terms. And the forward limit terms are all going to be labeled by a, b. So that factor is a, b, 1. Let's write it as j plus 1. So j is just labeling when, so j would go all the way up to n minus 1, okay? J equals n minus 1 is the first term that we just talked about. Mn is mn minus 1 plus its forward limit term. So the term with the j equals n minus 1 is that guy, okay? Is that guy's forward limit term. Huh? Oh, sorry, yeah. No, I'm just writing mn is mn minus 1 plus the n particle forward limit term, right? So let me call that forward limit n. But mn minus 1 is mn minus 2 plus the n minus 2 forward limit term.
sorry, n minus 1 forward limit term plus fn. And this is mn minus 3 plus the n minus 3, n minus 2, n minus 1 plus fn. So in this way, we go down to something where this is 0, okay, to the 3-particle forward limit term, the 3-particle loop amplitude, and we just get the sum. So in the end, this is the forward limit term for n minus, for n particles plus n minus 1 particles plus dot, dot, dot. So that's just the formula that I'm writing down. So it's just you write down the forward limit for n particles, and you just remove one, and the same forward limit picture going up to n minus 1, going up to n minus 2, and so on. Okay? So J is labeling which one of this is J, this index is J plus 1. Okay? So this term So that factor is just this, and now I have to write down this lower NMHV tree amplitude. Now, Freddie told you what the formula for the NMHV tree amplitudes were in general. So let me write down. So this is the NMHV tree amplitude going up to particle that has up to particle J in it. So I'm going to write down. Freddie gave you a presentation of the NMHV amplitudes that had the form of the sum over R invariance 1, k, k plus 1, l, l plus 1. Particle 1 was special, and you summed over all the rest of them, right? So that I'm sure he drew a picture like here is 1, and then we have 1, I plus 1, j. Let me call it k, k plus 1. L, L plus 1. Okay, so just summing over all of these guys. All right, so we're going to do exactly the same thing. So this lower amplitude doesn't have 1 here anymore, so it has 1, A, B, J, if you like, J plus 1, etc. All right, so we're going to get terms that look like 1, but that's a hat now, right? That's 1 a hat. We're going to have things that look like 1. So we'll have terms that look like 1 a hat b and a pair of other guys. Right. Oh, sorry. I apologize, first of all. Sorry. A hat b. Sorry. Yes. Sorry. S. Yes, yes. Sorry. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Because so we went down to M3. That's right. That's right. Where?
Here. Oh, this is M1 loop.
M1 loop equal, and then there's a plus sign between the two. Yes. This is that, the first line, and now?
The first line is multiplied by something.
Okay.
Yeah, it's multiplied because this term, that term is just writing. So. The sum over j is just the sum over these terms. So j equals n, j minus 1 equals n is that term, and so on. Okay? That factor is just this factor that's always stripped off from the inverse law factor. Now I'm writing down the lower point's tree amplitude. Okay? But the lower point tree amplitude is written in this configuration. And now this tree amplitude, if I use BCFW with the particle 1, just to decompose the tree amplitude, is the formula that Freddie wrote for you. And it would be 1, it has terms that look like 1b a hat ii plus 1. And it would have other terms, like 1 a hat something, 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 and then 1 that things that don't even involve a hat and b hat, things that don't even involve a, b. But the things that involve b and a would just be 1 a hat b ii plus 1. And the sum is I less than J because J is like, well, right, just because we're talking about, because we've gone down to the point where J plus 1 is the highest point that we're talking about, this NMHV amplitude. Okay? So there's that term in the NMHV tree amplitude, and there are other terms. The other terms don't, however, have the feature that there's no B in them anywhere.
The other terms either have only A hat or they have nothing. Okay? No dependence on B. The other terms, therefore, are zero when you do the... You see, here, what we now have to do is remove A and B on this GL2 contour. So we're doing D4A to A, D4A to B, so they vanish under the D4A to B integration. So the only things that have a chance for not vanishing on the D4A to B integration are the ones that I've kept. Okay?
Which term survives?
Exactly. And so, sorry, corrector, I should have also wrote a GL2 integral here. So that's what the... So I have to now also do a GL2 integral on this guy, right? So that's what that forward limit picture is with the removing these guys, and then I have to integrate. We have to integrate over ZA and ZB with that GL2 function. Right. Okay, so this is now all I have to stare at. Everything else just vanishes manifestly.
So can you just say, why don't it all be in the GL2
console? Well, I have to do the D4A to A, D4A to B integral, right?
Oh,
okay. Right. I have to do the D4A to A, D4A to B integral, so there has to be an A and a B. And there isn't an A, and all the terms that don't have a B in them don't have an A and a B, and so they just vanish under the D4A to A, D4A to B integration.
So, but that sounds like it should be easy in the momentum space too, right? Because it's just coming from the primary element. You're just telling me that you've got some... Ah, but it's all mixed up.
No, it's all, yeah, right. That's...
Okay.
You got it. Yeah. Okay, so this is
what... Is it true that only the second term in the relation contributes?
Sorry?
Only the second term contributes?
Yes, only the second term contributes. Yes.
Okay.
Only the second term contributes.
And the reason was?
The top term has two pieces in it. The top term has the one lower particle amplitude plus the interesting, all the other BCFW, all the other BCFW terms. So the one lower point amplitude piece contributes. Okay, so that's just what we wrote down. Mn, so Mn minus one is the piece that I just defined to be in the top part. Okay? Yes.
Why don't you just write
one of the pictures.
A generic FJ.
Oh, the generic FJ is exactly what I drew. This is what FJ is.
And where are the 3-point amplitude sticking out of some of the things?
So FJ is just the forward limit term that you get for particles 1 up to J plus 1.
Right, and the rest of sticking is a 3-level in
FJ. Yes, that's right, exactly. Sorry?
Where are they in your picture?
Well, where are what in the picture?
The other J plus 2n.
Right, very good. So what's going on is that all the other terms have been added here, if you like, by k preserving inverse soft factors. So they're just sitting there as k preserving inverse soft factors that fill up J plus 1 up to 1. The first term, the term of J equals 2 in the above sum, the term of J equals 2. There was a pole here at z equals infinity in this recursion relation in general. The pole at z equals infinity is the one lower particle amplitude, because that just merges zn is zn minus 1. Projectively, as z goes to infinity, zn is zn minus 1. So really, if you want to write it super explicitly, the recursion relation has three terms. It has a one lower point amplitude. It has all the other poles, all the other factorization, BCF factorization channels, and it has the forward limit. The one lower particle amplitude is the reason we group it with these ones is that in momentum space they would not be distinguished. In momentum space they're all BCFW terms. It's just that one of them is a BCFW term with a three particle MHV amplitude on one side. Okay? So that guy is not being a three particle anti MHV amplitude on one side. Okay? Three particle anti MHV amplitude on one side. Okay?
What's implicit what you're saying is that this amplitude is one in momentum two space.
No, just that. No, because it's zero.
It's the three.
This is the anti MHV vertex, not the MHV vertex. The MHV vertex is one. The anti MHV vertex isn't well defined in momentum twister space. Okay? But That's perfect. It's exactly well defined in the full momentum space. Remember, in going from the full amplitude to momentum twister space, you're factoring out this overall, MHV factor, and in the full amplitude, it's the factorization channel associated with that MHV prefactor, which is what's being beautifully taken into account by the pole of infinity here, just being the one lower particle amplitude. So you would draw physical factorization channels.
The physical factorization channels, there is a piece which has the anti-MHV vertex, three particle vertex on one side, just acting as a K-preserving inverse soft factor. Okay? So there's that piece, and there's all the rest of them. The formulas for those two pieces look different in momentum twister space. I gave you an explicit formula for what this times that is. Okay? And that's a formula that's valid for everything where those pieces on the left and the right are well defined. For k equals 0, 1, 2, up to everything else. There's one term, which is the one, the pole of z equals infinity, which is just the one lower particle amplitude. So we just choose to group them together, just defining the j equals 2 term here, to simply be the one lower particle amplitude. So there's a one lower particle amplitude, and then there is the forward limit. Yeah. Yes. Exactly. And that's why you just keep going down. So you get exactly. It's this MHV prefactor which we're stripping off in momentum twister space. Okay. No, so this is really the simplest version of the recursion relation, right? You go down, Mn is Mn minus 1 plus the N minus 1 particle forward limit, but then you keep going. Mn minus 1 is Mn minus 2 plus its forward limit, so you just get a sum of a bunch of forward limits with particles removed, one at a time. The N, just that picture. Okay. So now we just have to learn how to do this. We have to do that GL2 integral. Oh, we have to do the whole integral, actually. Okay, so let me write it out. The first term was a fermionic delta function, which is delta 4, A to A, B, 1, J, J plus 1, plus A to B, Yes.
The momentum mentioned delta factor, the delta function is using the prefactor.
Yes.
Involve more particles than the one. So in total,
yes.
Just take the one here. Don't.
That's the beauty of momentum twisters. Momentum twisters let you do anything the hell you want and guarantee that momentum is conserved. Okay? Because that's the point. You completely unconstrained data hands you things that are null separated, conserve momentum, etc.
I mean, it's just like if you do PCFW at tree, just pure tree level PCFW on the special case of an MHV amplitude, all that happens is you pull off, it's just one term in the recursion, you pull off a 3-point MHV bar.
Right.
When you go to momentum twister space, that 3-point MHV bar doesn't even turn into one. All it does is affect the relationship between the momentum twisters and the original momentum. Okay. And it does it in such a way that the momentum conserving delta function, everything just works out. Right. So that's Mn minus 1 is when you pulled it off once. Mn minus 2 is when you take the chain of the data. But then there's this extra fourth limit term, which is where all the. That's the first. Five bracket,
and the second five bracket is delta 4 of. Let me just isolate the pieces that I care about. These are the fermionic delta functions. Delta 4 of a to a hat, b I plus 1 plus dot dot dot, see why I don't care about those in a second, over, well, A hat B I I plus 1, B I plus 1, 1, I plus 1, A hat B, I plus 1, 1 A hat B. 2, 3, 4, and 1 A, sorry, the first one I forgot to write, 1 A hat B I. Okay. So this is it, and I have to do D 4 A to A, D 4 A to B on this. And after I'm done that, I have to do the Okay, let's do first do that, then I have to do the GL2 integral. Okay, so let's first do D4 A to A, D4 A to B. So this is actually, where here A hat is equal to B J, J plus 1, 1, A minus A J, J plus 1, B. Okay, that's what I got from the shift up there. All right, so that's nice because you notice that this combination up here in this first invariant is just the eta of A hat. Okay? Oops, so that's why I should have, let me write eta B. That's the only one I'm going to need. Okay? That one's eta A hat. So I can very easily do the D4 eta A, D4 eta B integral. Just by doing the D4 A to A hat, D4 A to B integral. Okay? So all I just have to pay is just the trivial Jacobian that A to A is equal to, so let's just write out the factor. Oh, sorry. Okay, great. Wonderful. That fills me with confidence about how I'm doing. And about the point of what I'm now doing. Actually, that's very liberating, Pedro. I can write any kind of crap now. Oh, this one? No, that's not true. That's not true. That's not true. You should have stopped me then. All right. So I can do the D4 A to A, D4 A to B integral, and all I get is, it's A hat. Many apologies. Okay. I get B1 I J, J plus 1 to the fourth. Then from the A to B, I get A hat I plus 1, 1 to the fourth. And that's it for the A to A, A to B integral. Okay, that's what I get from A to A, A to B. And now I have my gigantic denominator, which has, let's first collect everything that depends on AB. Okay, but now let's think a little bit. A hat, remember, is the point where A moves along the line AB till it intersects the plane 1J, J plus 1. Okay? So A hat is only a function of the line AB. Okay? So we want to isolate the things here that just depend on AB and the things that don't depend manifestly on the line. Because those are the things that we're going to do the GL2 integral on. Okay? So we have to do that. So everything inside, so let's just then, actually, so while we're at it, let's look at, here's something that very naively depends on A, but of course it depends on A hat, so this is a quantity that actually depends on the line AB. Let's work out what it is. How does it depend on the line AB? Let me do that over here. So, well, it's very simple. It's just A hat 1 I plus 1 is A, I mean, this is just the is A 1ii plus 1, b1j, j plus 1, minus a1j, j plus 1, b1ii plus 1. Okay? So this is manifestly anti-symmetric in a and b, so it's a function of the line ab. And we define this sort of object occurs over and over again, so we define this to be AB times the intersection of the plane 1ii plus 1 with 1jj plus 1. Okay? So it's AB times some line. But what is that line? That line is the intersection of the two planes, 1ii plus 1 and 1jj plus 1. That's how you can interpret, if you want to write this explicitly, very explicitly as a function of the line AB, that's what it is. It is AB, and what occurs here is some XY, where that XY is the line, which is the intersection of 1ii plus 1 and 1jj plus 1. Okay? If you don't like that, what we really mean by it is this expression. It's manifestly SL2 invariant, so it's a function of the line. Yes? You can write it like that as well. Yes, you can write it that way as well. You can write it as two other terms and just manifestly function of the line AB. But I'm telling you in more detail what it is. It's AB, and the thing which is appearing there is its geometrical meaning is the intersection of these two points. Okay. So, all right. So we know what that guy means. Something else which is very obvious here is that anytime you have A hat B is just proportional to AB. Right? A hat B is just proportional to AB with the factor BJ, JJ plus 1. So now this is very easy. So let's first write out, let's collect everything that explicitly depends on AB. So there's AB 1J, there's AB JJ plus 1, there's AB 1J plus 1, or J plus 1, 1. I'm not going to be very careful about signs here. Then there's, from the downstairs, there's AB, sorry? Thank you. Okay. From the downstairs, there's AB II plus 1 with a factor of BJJ plus 1 downstairs. So that's just going to reduce one of these. Then I have AB II plus 1. Oops, sorry, that's the one I did. Then I have AB, I plus 1, 1, 1, yeah, I plus 1, 1. That knocks it down to 2. Then I have AB, 1, I. Which knocks it down to 1. Yes. Oh, did I write it wrong? Oh, did I? So it should have been A hat B I plus 1, A hat B I plus 1, 1 AB, 1 AB. What am I missing? I wrote down I plus 1 twice. Is that what you're saying? No, you're right. So it's 1 A hat B I plus 1. So I wrote down A hat B I plus 1, B I plus 1, 1, I plus 1, 1 A hat. Oh, that should have been 1 A hat. Okay? Thank you. Thank you. Then I plus 1, 1 A hat B, and then 1 A hat B I. Okay? Great. Thank you. So the terms that I just did were... what? So from down here, I did this one to get ABII plus 1. Then I did, then I did AB1I plus 1 there and AB1I there. Okay, good. Good. Then I have one of these factors, which is canceling against one of the guys up here, so I have this thing cubed. All right, and now who else do I have? Now I have all the guys that are not manifestly a function of AB. So I have something that looks like 1 over 1 over B1JJ plus 1. That one cancels this one. Then I have 1 over A1JJ plus 1. And that's it. And from here, I have 1 over BII plus 1, 1. All right, so that's what we have. All right. So now, yeah. So now I've done. Now all I've done is do the GL. All I've done is do the A to B integral and clean things up a little bit. Okay. So now we have to do the GL2 integral on this guy. And notice again, it's exactly like last time. It's exactly like what happened in our general case. We have an integral B3ZA, B3ZB. There's something that only depends on AB, and there's exactly two factors which depend on A and B. Okay. So just as before, it's exactly the same integral. The integral just gives me 1 over the line AB times the intersection of this plane with that plane. So now I do the GL2 integral, and I just get 1 over AB times 1JJ plus 1 intersect 1II plus 1. And of course, that's exactly what this guy is upstairs. A hat 1II plus 1 is exactly what we decided is the same guy. So that leaves us with the Kermit formula that I had written yesterday. So I apologize, this is very, very boring, but stop once you might want to see what one of these computations looks like. Oh, notice, sorry, but maybe there is something I should highlight. The fact that this has a linear term in A and B, right? So the structure of the GL2 integral is exactly the same as before, is CA, BCA, CB, BCB, over CA, CB, times CA times phi A, CB, phi B. And remember, the CA and CB were such as ZA, ZB, these were the GL2 transformation. Is the GL2 transformation CCCC times ZA, ZB, right? So I just want to point out that we were instructed from the forward limit picture to encircle poles where the points little Z and little ZB were identified with each other. Okay? That's the pole here where CA is equal to CB. Okay? And again, in this case, you get the same answer no matter what. So I can, for example, I do the integral over CA first. I set CA equal to CB. I'm left with the integral over CB to do. I get a unique answer. Okay? And it's just 1 over phi A phi B. But it is worth pointing out that the pole that we needed for the forward limit is exactly there. Okay? This 1 over CA CB pole allows there to exist the configuration where A and B lie on top of each other as I move them along the line. Okay. So I'm doing the GL2 integral on the prescribed contour. Okay, it's forcing me to do it in a place where there's fortunately a pole and I get an answer. Okay. And the answer is unique. Okay, so that then leaves me with the answer. So I'm left with the sum of I less than j of AB 1II plus 1 intersect 1JJ plus 1 squared over AB 1I ABII plus 1, ABI plus 1, 1, B1J, which we denoted as yesterday. Okay. That's the point. You see, when I say that this Yangian crapola is computationally useful, that's really where you feel it, because if you're forced to do it, we really felt it because we were trying to do it the other way for quite a long time, and it's very delicate. You're approaching the forward limit. You want, you know, there's zeros, and you, but somehow by, well, I mean, of course it's all well defined, but when you have to take it as a limit versus taking it as a contour integral, it's much nicer to take it as a contour integral. Right. No, that's really the nub of the point, right there. Right. You can ask Jake. He will tell you what the difference it made to his life. You know? Yeah, right. Right, exactly. I mean, that's right. That's the conceptual point, but it actually helps you, you know, it helps you do the calculation. Okay, so the final thing I wanted, that's the form that you get for the MHV amplitude. I told you about some things that we get for the other cases. You can look in the paper and see the explicit form of the six particle NMHV amplitude and see that it has this form that I was mentioning yesterday, that it doesn't come out in a factorized form as residue times integral. It's much more intertwined in an interesting way, et cetera. So there's a lot to be thought about and explored with what this recursion relation is telling us. It would be wonderful to solve it. It'd be wonderful to try to come up with an in principle formal solution of it. Here, in the way I've described it, you write things out, and then you have to do a GL2 integral by hand. Okay, we did the little GL2 integral by hand, but it turns out that if you start solving the recursion relation recursively, then you can do it in a canonical way to be able to do the GL2 integrals explicitly ahead of time, and then just have a dead algebraic expression where you don't even have to do some GL2 integral by hand. So that's something that we've been developing. So there's a lot to be said and explored about it. But one very important thing, which I mentioned yesterday, is the integrand is not being spat out in a manifestly local form. Okay? It's being spat out in terms of the sum of terms, each of which have spurious poles, and the spurious poles cancel in the sum. So, the final topic is I want to tell you about how to write the amplitude in a local form. Fortunately, I have a cab picking me up at 5. So this is now a serious question. it is a serious question, yes, about... And it's not from here quite either. That's right. Let me make one very quick general comment, and then I'll move on. The general comment is the fact that we've written the integrand in a way that makes the Yangian invariance manifest. I've said it a few times, but it should have very striking consequences for the simplicity of the integral. To see why, let's just start off seeing, even for MHV amplitudes, what is the consequence of the fact that the amplitude is even invariant under super, the super part of dual conformal invariants. So the statement is that something, the sum over A, the fermionic variables, DDZA, the bosonic variables, K, J, on the amplitude is equal to zero, formally, right? But this thing doesn't have any fermionic variables at all, so just super dual conformal invariants, nothing fancy, says that DDZA on the amplitude is just equal to zero for any A. So super dual conformal invariance alone tells you the amplitude is a constant. That's very simple to be a constant. Okay? Now, of course, the amplitudes are not a constant. So what's going on? Well, at the level of the integrand, at the level, and this is correct for tree amplitudes, right? In momentum Twister space, the only super dual conformal invariant with for MHV is a constant, one. So what's going on at the level of the integrand is that that's a true statement. It's a sharp statement. It's really a sharp statement that says that if you look at DDZA of anything, DDZA of the amplitude turns into some DDZAK with some function FA plus DDZB of the integrand now, of the integrand. Okay? So it's a total derivative, and you can work out exactly what total derivative it is. Okay? That's something that's true term by term. It's true term by term in the form that we get. That's the point of each term being eigeninvariant. It is not true term by term in other ways of writing the answer. Okay, but it's true term by term here. Each term by term, the derivative with respect to the external particles of the integrand is a total derivative. So if you integrated it and the answer was sensible in any way, you would get zero for the derivative. It's not zero. It's not zero only because the integral is not perfectly well defined. It's not zero because we hit infrared divergences on the contour of integration that we're choosing. But that means that there should be some nice differential equation. Right? There should be some equation which is just the action of the super dual conformal generators on the integral is not zero, but is something which is localized to the places where the infrared divergences occur. Now, the infrared divergences occur when the loop momenta become collinear to the external particles. When they become collinear to the external particles is, of course, the edges of the Wilson loop. Oops. Well, actually, they become collinear to the external particles anywhere along these extended lines. Okay? Collinear to the Wilson loop. But a little bit of extra thought involving staring at I epsilons convinces you that the places where the infrared divergences are actually coming from, where they're non-zero, where they're not, is actually literally the edges of the Wilson loop. Literally, not just the whole line, but the edges between the cusps. Okay? The infrared divergences, the things that make these integrals ill-defined are completely localized along the cusps, along the segments that go between the cusps of the Wilson loop, literally the polygon. Sorry? The segments. Okay? That's actually the point. You see, this is why it's really the segments, and this is why I think people hadn't seen any nice action of anything other than bosonic dual conformal invariants. The reason is, if you act with super dual conformal invariants on the answer, you're not going to recognize it immediately as a nice local object. What it is something that's localized, not quite a local object. It's an integral that's localized along the whole loop, around the whole loop. But it doesn't give you a local answer. The bosonic dual conformal invariants gives you a local anomaly, which is why you can see it. But it doesn't mean that the other ones aren't there. In fact, there's really something there. It's something that's, I mean, this is very powerful information. It's something that's not a random integrand. This integral is mostly zero, and is just localized to a few places where the divergences are. Okay? This means that it's not that there are loop amplitudes and too bad they're infrared divergent. It's that loop amplitudes are only non-zero because they're infrared divergent, because of the collinear singularities. The only reason they exist is the collinear singularities. Oh, yeah. Sorry?
Are there many terms that for you define that for you to
go? What do you mean, the many terms?
The integrand?
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. No, no, no. All of them are divergent. In fact, let me say, at the moment, it's even more confusing than that. Because each Kermit term is non-local, right? Each Kermit term has local poles and non-local poles. And at the moment, we do not know a practical way. We know some conceptual ways, but we don't know a workably practical way of taking one of these non-local Kermit integrals and regularizing this integral, this non-local integral. The reason is that we know how to regularize all of these integrals when they're in local form. In local form, for those of you who aren't experts in the subject, this is one of the wonderful things which has happened is that there's nice regularizations when you write loop integrals in momentum twister space that is not dim reg, which is much more physical. You just move out along the Coulomb branch of the theory. You give masses to some of the internal particles, and that regulates things. And in momentum twister space, it's just beautiful. You take the local propagators, 1 over AB, 1, 2, and you replace it by 1 over AB, 1, 2, plus M squared, angle bracket AB, angle bracket 1, 2. So that breaks dual conformal invariance, but that's fine. It's a beautifully physical regularization. But we know how to do that. We know exactly how to do it when the integrand is manifestly local. In other words, it's a physical thing that we're doing. We're going out along the Higgs branch. We're generating physical local masses. And we don't just randomly modify propagators. We're putting the M squareds there because the particles have gotten a mass. At the moment, we don't know what the non-local, we don't know what local regularization, how it's implemented directly on the non-local terms. That's what we mean, right? But that's exactly the same. Yes, exactly. But it's non-local in precisely the same sense that BCF terms at tree level are non-local because they're secretly coming from underlying one-loop diagrams. Okay, so we mean non-local. You can generate poles like that from local processes, but at higher loop order. Okay, just the same as in BCFW. Now what we can do is we know that all the spurious poles cancel, so we can take these guys, put them all together, and see that we get the local result. Then we can regulate the local result, and first of all, we can just regulate the local result and now compute the answer. I will show you the nice way of talking about the local integrand, which makes this particularly transparent. But from the point of view of this argument, what you could do is regulate them and then figure out what that meant going back to the non-local guys individually. But there must be a nicer way of doing it. Okay? So that's one of our conceptual obstacles right now. We don't know precisely how to think about regularizing these non-local guys. It might be that they have a very beautiful physical meaning. I don't know if they directly have a beautiful physical meaning because they're somehow what, I don't know, it's what Yangian invariant observers would want to measure. it's not clear that that's closely related to what detectors on spatial surfaces with fixed energy resolution want to detect, but maybe there are other things that are more naturally detected. But anyway, that's one of our issues. Yeah. Yeah, but if you like, understanding that question would probably help a lot in understanding what it's supposed to mean here, right? Right. Okay, but nonetheless, it still stands. It still stands that there's a qualitative lesson here, which is that the entire loop amplitude is a consequence of the infrared divergence here. Okay, when we described this to a Peter Goddard, he said in a very pithy way, he said that the loop integrand is saying I diverge, therefore I am. Okay, so. And that's, to me, a quite striking fact, and it's sort of the only way that is consistent with the fact that on, especially for MHV amplitudes, on any reasonable contour you just get one, okay, but the integrand is being presented in a way now where the bits and pieces are such that the derivatives of the external particles just turn into total derivatives everywhere. The whole integrand is correct. And if you sat down and computed it, put it on a computer, you'd get all the dialogues and everything. It's right. but it's being spat out in the form where each term individually is as close as it can to not being anything, as close as it can to being a constant. Okay? Somehow everything is localized along the edges of the Wilson loop. And so that's telling us ahead of time, just qualitatively telling us ahead of time, that these are lower dimensional integrals. They're not complicated. They're not as complicated as big multidimensional 4L dimensional integrals. They're much lower dimensional integrals, and that should be related to why they look simple. Okay? Yes? Yes, yeah, that's right, exactly. No, that's precisely the sort of regularization that we're starting to, that, you see, so that's the game that we've been trying to play for quite a while now, and with varying degrees of success. But I should say that it feels a hell of a lot like what it must have felt like for people when they were first regulating quantum field theories, regulating UV divergences, okay? You can do them, and you worry about all sorts of things that end up seeming very irrelevant when everything is understood. In particular, it looks like the differential equation here is like some kind of anomaly equation. So it would have naively been ddz I is equal to 0, and it's ddz I equals to something that isn't 0. Because it's an anomaly, probably, if we were smart enough, we could just write down what the right-hand side can possibly be, just on symmetry grounds. Especially now that we're so good at building fancy Yangian invariants, the right-hand side of this equation is some other fancy Yangian invariant. It's a fancy Yangian invariant that should not have the interpretation of a full loop integral. Should somehow be a fancy Yangian invariant that's, which is somehow associated with the Wilson loop, okay, with a lower dimensional integral around the Wilson loop. So the hope is that there is some sort of simple chain of differential equations that maps the amplitude to other Yangian invariants. Remember, I told you there's a whole ton of objects we can build with these operations that we've barely explored. It could be that some of them are the Wilson loop, by the way. Okay, so we haven't even touched that question yet. It would be wonderful to express the Wilson loop directly in a way that's manifestly Yangian invariant. Okay, maybe so. There's a Wilson loop. There's all sorts of other objects that could be lying around here that have a role to play in this chain of differential equations. And I think it's this chain of I'm going through this argument because I think it's a chain of differential equations that's going to make contact with you guys somehow. Ultimately, you don't see anything like the integrand directly. You're seeing the answer. And how are we going to make contact with the answer? Well, right. Exactly. No, of course. That's what I'm saying. It seems like what you guys are seeing is the kind of most least redundant way of expressing the answer. We have more redundant ways of expressing the answer. The loop integrand is giving you a more redundant way of expressing the answer, but it's also telling you that it wants to be less redundant. Okay? And so I've just been saying words for the last 10 minutes, but I'm saying them because I think they're important. We don't have to hunt around for random differential equations that these integrals satisfy. It's the Yangian. it's just beginning with something as simple as superdual conformal invariants. And just studying it should hopefully tell us how to actually do the computations. As I say, we've been saying these words for a reasonable amount of time now without making them much more concrete, but hopefully there's something to be done there. Okay, now I wanted to tell you about the local integrand, but I'm a little bit screwed. Let's see. Are you still around next week, Jay? Are you interested? Well, are you interested in talking about the local integrand? Or do you want to talk about the local integrand, Freddie? Or Simone could do it as well. That's right. That's right. I think I shouldn't start. This is actually a very important part of this story. Let me just summarize in words. Let me summarize in words, and then you can talk to these guys, and maybe it'll be described in more detail later. So the integrand we can now get just analytically, numerically, however the heck you want, spat out of the BCFW recursion relations. Great, we have the integrand, but for two reasons you might want to see it written in a standard local form. One reason is just to compare to anyone else in the world who's never seen anything in BCFW form. And actually, secondly, not purely for sociological reasons, because written in local form, we know exactly how to regulate it. We know precisely what it means to regulate it. So until we can do slightly better than that, directly in the non-local form, at least we know precisely what it means. And third, of course, it's just a tremendous check on the entire formalism, that you have the sum of like tons and tons and tons of BCFW terms, and they add up to something which is manifestly local with all the spurious false canceling. Okay, well, this is what you would think in principle people have been doing for years and years, and they have been. But somehow, well, for a variety of reasons, people related to the fact that people have not been staring at the full integrand. Actually, even the local forms of one-loop amplitudes for generic one-loop amplitudes are not available in the literature. But worse than it not being available, just the very psychology for writing them out, expanding them in terms of boxes, scalar integrals, boxes, and so on, is just, from the point of view of the integrand, is simply incorrect. Okay? Especially when you write things in terms of boxes at one loop, boxes are completely parity symmetric functions, and the integrand is not. Okay? The amplitudes are not. You fix some helicity configuration, the amplitude is not. So it's just wrong. And also because parity isn't a particularly good symmetry, it's also wrong to divide it up into parity even plus parity odd. It's just not the way the integrand wants to be written. Instead, the integrand is most naturally written directly as integral over lines in momentum twister space. Okay? And let me give you a very simple example. So here's an example of, so the simplest sort of example we saw already, D4ZA, D4ZB, over vol GL2 all the time. And then we have the 1 over AB12, AB23, up to AB41, 1, 2, 3, 4 squared. So this is an example of a nice, simple, massless box. But let's say you want to write a pentagon integral. Then you could write down something with 5 ABs, 1, 2, up to 5, 1. But it has to have a single AB upstairs just to make all the AB weights work out. Now, the things that have the interpretation of x minus x, some xj squared in the dual spacetime, this is the sort of 10 factors that people write down all the time when they write D4x integrals. These things just map to things that look like AB j minus 1j. So you'd see factors like that. But from the momentum twister point of view, there's nothing particularly special about that particular combination of objects. And you might want to write down more generally things like A, B, X, Y, where these are not necessarily adjacent to each other. Okay? Let me write them KL. Okay? They're not necessarily adjacent to each other. These correspond back in space-time. You could, of course, write as a D4X integral if you like, but it would involve x minus some special point, x star kl squared, where that x star kl is the point in spacetime that's associated with the line kl. But this is some in general complex point. Okay? It's not the sort of thing that if you're just staring at D4x, staring at planar pictures, your eye is immediately drawn to, putting in these funny complex points. But when you play with the momentum twister integrals, you just do it automatically. It just happens to you whether you like it or not. And in fact, you find that these complex points are playing a very important role in the whole story. Okay? Indeed, a very standard, an interesting sort of object that comes up again and again in our is things like this. When AB13, and I guess here we'd have 1, 2, 4, 5, 3, 2, 4, 5, cancel all the for all the little group weights. So you notice again, it has one of these magic numerators, okay? One of these funny, interesting points. So we denote graphically that guy by a picture like, so we have a pentagon, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and we draw a dotted line here, indicating that there's a numerator that's connecting 1 and 3. So that's indicating that there's numerator factor AB 1, 3. Often we're also interested in talking about the parity conjugates of these points. So the point Z1 is associated naturally with the plane, for example, 5, 1, 2. In general, the point J is associated with the plane J minus 1, J1, J plus 1. So if we wrote AB XY, we can also write AB, if you like, X bar Y bar, where that's the parity conjugates of these points, which would be AB times the intersection of X minus 1, X, X plus 1, intersect Y minus 1, Y, Y plus 1. Okay? And when we have that sort of numerator, we denote it by a wavy line. Okay? So if I were to write AB 1 bar, 3 bar, I would denote it by a wavy line in this picture. Okay? Now, the important point of these kinds of integrals is that notice that these don't have any nice parity property anymore. They're fundamentally chiral. Okay? These are fundamentally chiral integrals. That's good. The amplitude is also fundamentally a chiral object. And this is something I will not have time to explain properly. But it turns out that that at one loop order, two loop order, very likely at any loop order, there is a very natural basis for all local integrands that's built out of integrals which crucially make use of these magic numerator factors. And the important feature that they have is that they're maximally chiral integrals. They're chiral integrals, and this is the really important point. All of their leading singularities, all of the non-zero residues they have, if you cut the propagators, are 1 or minus 1, or 0. Okay? So we say that these objects have unit leading singularity. They're chiral momentum twister integrals with unit leading singularity. This is somewhat non-obvious that such integrals exist. In fact, if you stare at one of them, if I hand you one of them and you just go ahead and check, compute this leading singularity and compute another leading singularity, and ask, are they the same? It would look like it takes some, often takes some miraculous Schouten identities involving four brackets for them to be the same, and of course it happens. And every time miraculous identities involving rational functions happens, it has the same explanation, and it's the global residue theorem applied to the loop integrand. Okay, the global residue theorem applied to these loop integrands guarantees that they have unit leading singularities. Okay? But that means that there is a very natural, so they don't look like boxes, anything like boxes. Okay? But there is a natural basis of objects which have unit leading singularities and are therefore perfectly suited to capturing the singularity structure of the theory. Okay? Another remarkable thing happens. Many of these integrals are much more finite than you are used to in talking about one loop and especially multi-loop integrals. In fact, the naively hardest integrals are finite, dead infrared finite. And that's because these numerator factors turn out to put zeros in exactly the configurations that would give you infrared divergences. Okay? The configurations that give you infrared divergences in momentum twister space, so it's when momenta become collinear to external particles. If you phrase that statement in momentum twister space, it's when the line AB passes through some point. Let's say when the line AB passes through the point 2, lying in the plane 1, 2, 3. Okay? So passing through the point 2, lying in the plane 1, 2, 3, means back in dual space that it's along the segment, along one of the segments of the, along one of the lines of the Wilson loop. But you see, this numerator factor, AB13, precisely makes that, puts a zero in that configuration. If it just passes through 2 in any way, if it passes through 1 or passes through 3, then it puts a zero there. And if it passes through 2 lying in the plane 1, 2, 3, it puts a zero there as well. Okay. So, yeah. Right. So indeed. So all the divergences are fundamentally associated with collinearity. Of course, you can get more. We can get worse if it happens twice. Okay, that's where the double logs come from. But what happens with most generic and naively hardest integrals is that you even kill completely the collinear ones. Okay, so they're just so there's no room for any divergences to occur. And the one that they've explicitly computed, they've turned out to be finite. So just as a simple example, here's a nice two-loop integral for six particles. And this integral is completely finite. And I can replace these lines by these, I could have wiggly or dotted lines on any one of them. One more thing, which is totally obvious with momentum twisters, writing the integrals with the momentum twisters, is how to reduce integrals. So this is one of the old stories with loop integration, to do integral reduction. Okay? Integral reduction is a completely trivial story using momentum twisters. No. This is just a nice loop integral. Okay? Not saying anything about Yangian invariance or anything. At the moment, the story is just that even if you want to finally write the integral in a local form, the way of doing it using boxes and things like that is maximally obscure. Okay? And the nice way of doing it is directly in terms of momentum twister integrals. Okay? Each one of these things will not be manifestly Yangian invariant, will not be manifestly anything like that. So we get the BCFW form. We get the answer. Then we built a basis of all of these objects. For one and two loops, as I said, it's likely extendable to any loop order. But for one and two loops, there's a full basis of chiral objects with unit-leading singularities. The hardest ones are finite, okay, which are the ones where the amplitude naturally wants to be written. Let me just—there's a lot I could say. About it, which I'm obviously not going to be able to say. Let me just make two more comments. One of them is that these integrals are also likely to be very simple. Even though they're not Yangian invariant and stuff like that, they're also likely to be very simple. The reason is closely related to the fact that they have unit-leading singularities. Because they have unit-leading singularities, it means that if you did these integrals on any kind of closed contour at all, the answer is either 1 or 0. That means if you differentiate the integral with respect to any of the external particles, you would naively get 0. It would, again, naively turn into a total derivative. Because on any closed contour, it would give you 0. So these are very special integrals. It's not that easy to write something down which has unit-leading singularities everywhere. As I said, if you write down totally generic integrals, it won't happen. But these special guys with these special numerators, applying the global residue theorem to them shows that all the leading singularities are 1 and minus 1. And that means that they're also likely to be integrals that are localized to the edges of the Wilson loop. Even when they're finite, they're likely to be localized to the edges of the Wilson loop. That thing ends up being finite, but it's sort of just finite. And then when you go and test these things that I said, you take its derivative and so on, you can just break it in such a way that there's room for anomalous contributions. So these are also very likely to be very, very simple integrals. That should be nice to compute. The final point is that actually staring at the integrand directly, so we can get it from BCFW, we can then write it in local form. And when you write in local form, you pay a slight price at one loop. If you like, well, it's not a price, it's just true. You're seeing what the integrand looks like. But, you know, if you're just looking at the box expressions that you're familiar with in the literature, you're familiar with them. And they're simple to say, it's sum of all two mass easy boxes for the MHV amplitude, something like that. Okay? If you stare at the answer full integrand for the MHV amplitude, it has boxes and it has pentagons in it as well. Okay? So that's the most general things are sums of boxes and pentagons. Okay, but once you start looking at the full integrand, you can start seeing patterns that would be very difficult to see if you're only looking at an artificially chopped off parity even piece of it. Okay? And what happened is that we started actually looking at two loop integrals. And we computed them with BCFW, and this is what we found. So here's the four-particle amplitude. So that's the 1, 2, 3, 4. So that's the sort of standard form everyone has seen, plus cyclic. So here I'm adding the cyclic copies of everybody. Then the five-particle amplitude. Already the five-particle amplitude is written in a form that's different than people have seen normally at two loops. So it has... So it's just these two simple terms. Okay. And the six-particle amplitude, again, the exercise was we got the integrand with BCFW, we had built this basis of local objects, which were nice, and we expanded the answer in terms of them. And so once again, this is a very powerful check that the whole formalism is correct, because all these BCFW terms have big spurious poles, lots of spurious poles. They all have to cancel to give rise to these manifestly local forms, and of course they do. Actually, there's some more terms here. Let me just draw more schematically what it looks like. It's all these wiggly lines. So once again, these are naively the hardest integrals, or these double pentagon integrals, but these are dead finite. And all the divergences are in the simplest ones. Okay. Anyway, so having gotten to this picture, so I didn't write the one loop, what the one loop guys look like. No. They're finite and nice. Yeah, they're finite, nice finite integrals. Okay. So, meanwhile, the structure of the one loop, the general one loop MHV amplitude, involves some sum of boxes. They're a dual conformal invariant. Yes. This is all momentum twister space. They're manifestly finite. These are going to be very canonical, nice objects, okay? Nice canonical integrals. Yeah. Okay. Perhaps. So. So it turns out, a little bit ironically, that when you write, there's a number of ways of writing the one-loop integrand, but one of the nicest forms of writing it for MHV amplitude, this is all for MHV, one of the nicest ways of writing it is Dave is laughing for a good reason, is boxes plus pentagons, but the boxes precisely do not contain the two mass easy boxes, okay? That's right. General mass of legs in the bottom here, sorry. So it's two mass hard boxes plus pentagons, all right? The parity even part is the sum of two mass easy terms, but this is the full integrand. Now, you probably can't, I'll just have to declare it, but you'll see that, you'll notice that the four-particle amplitude and the five-particle amplitude and the six-particle amplitude look like they're just squaring that picture. You just take that picture and you put its pieces together. For four and for five and up to six, you have to go up to six to see the most generic situation with these double pentagons. But once you see it, it motivates a conjecture for the most general two-loop MHV amplitude for any number of particles. And it's just a sum of three kinds of terms. This sort of term, where now you put any number of massive legs here. This sort of term? Yeah, it's clear from the picture. That's right. With any number of massive things here and the double pentagon. Okay? Any number of massive legs. I'm sorry. I meant to draw here. Thank you. I didn't draw the wavy line yet. I would have noticed it if I did that. That and these guys. So again, these guys are dead finite. And we can have any number of guys, massive guys here, massive guys there. So that's three basic. So the full two-loop MHV amplitude conjecture is just the sum of those three kinds of momentum twister integrals. Okay? So you see, seeing the full integrand lets you see a pattern immediately that would be very difficult to see just staring at the parity even pieces. So as I mentioned before, the parity even piece was computed by Vergu earlier this year, and it's a pretty lengthy expression. You don't see any obvious pattern in it, but when you stare at the full integrand, you see patterns. So this is a nice local form of the answer. It's still quite surprising that the local form ends up looking so nice, but there's an extremely nice local form of the answer, and so this is it's a conjecture. But it's been checked against the BCFW form of the amplitude up to, I don't know how many points it is now, up to 26 points. Okay, so you can compare with the 26 points two-loop MHV amplitude, which you just get out of BCFW, and it matches this formula. At 26 points, is that the 49,000 number of the paper, or is it bigger now? So there's 99,000 terms in BCFW for the 26 particle two-loop MHV amplitude. They're there. They have all of them. And oh, you mean do
these integrals?
It's
So what I want to say is that since it's so easy to get the integrand using BCFW,
there's lots and lots of data you can generate and play with, just at the level of the integrand. So it would be very nice to just prove this conjecture directly. I suspect it would be easy to prove it directly, that this local form is actually the right answer. But you need to see the whole integrand to see patterns like this. Right. So there's two interesting open classes of questions having to do with these integrals. Just the integrals themselves. I think the deeper question is trying to interpret, regulate, and directly compute the Yangian invariant terms, Yangian invariant forms of the integrand directly. But these local objects also seem very canonical. There seems to be something good about them, and we know exactly how to regulate them ahead of time. We don't have to think about that part. But they should also be some very, very nice objects that would be nice to figure out how to compute. And the paper of Drummond and Henn is a very, very nice step in that direction, to try to see that, in fact, when you do these finite integrals, they do come out looking relatively simple. So anyway, that was way, way too fast for that last part. But you can talk to these guys, and also I'm sure Simone will do a wonderful job talking about it when he visits as well. So thank you very much.